have a few minutes to take some questions. Go ahead. Maybe just come to the mic and introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Deanne. I'm a graduate student at McGill. I'm also part of UAEM McGill. And I have two questions, one for Dr. Uberli-Joro. The first question is, how can you ensure that the intellectual patents that are created by the compounds that you discover, that they don't get sold back to the pharmaceutical companies in the West, and that you are able to create like a local economy with these compounds and keep it in, I guess, to help the local economy? And my second question goes to Dr. Wasan. As you may know, the McGill environment is pretty corporate and tendency to want to make money. And so how do you think is the best way for us to reach the faculty and make them aware of this other way of licensing their discoveries? Thank you.
Okay. So one of the things I'd like to start by saying is the intellectual property that was given to us from the pharmaceutical companies was given to us without any strings attached. So we can do whatever we want with it. So that was really crucial in terms of starting out. And in terms of selling back, the idea is to create a system where the natural product library would be sustained by funding. So we'd never, selling the patents wouldn't be effective. Licensing out to allow, let's say, because one of the things I really liked, Michael mentioned the chronic disease area. And one of the issues I see a lot when I'm in Africa is people who are at their most active will die of chronic diseases, and there'll be a loss, an intellectual loss, a family loss, humongous loss. Because we have people who are vibrant, who are extremely well-trained, who are dying of chronic diseases in Africa. And one area, for example, we'd like to move forward with would be using the library for screening for cardiovascular diseases. So in this case, if we found any drugs, clearly they'd be applicable to global health. So North America, Africa, everywhere. And these would be of interest to pharma. And what would be interesting in this space would be licensing agreements where the intellectual property stays in Africa, but with help, with funding, with partnerships, partnering with pharma to be able to move forward. And the idea of partnerships and licensing is that funding would continuously go back to Africa. And what's the crucial part about, you know, why sell them is, as a consortium, our interest is creating a system that allows new funding mechanisms that will be coming in for researchers in Africa to keep moving forward. So the interest in maintaining the sustainability of the system is finding creative ways where, how are we going to get new funding? And if we can get funding coming in through licensing agreement that can go back to research locally, that's the incentive. So there'd be no interest in selling it off, because the intent is not for anybody in the consortium to get rich. The intent is to build local capacity and have a network built locally to help drug discovery advance in Africa. So it's really about the vision and how do you keep it sustainable.
So the second question was, how do we convince McGill to... have him move to UBC. Yeah, you know, so, I mean, there's a bit of this. I've been reading some of the McGill press, and they have taken some of the stuff that's happened at our university and twisted it a little bit. So I'm happy you've asked that question, and she wasn't planted in the audience. So, you know, the Global Access Initiative at the University of British Columbia is not an all-or-none policy. It doesn't mean that every technology that we develop has to be under global access. What happens is the following, is that the technology is flagged by the UILO at UBC, and they come and ask you, are you something that you're interested in? So I think the first thing that you have to say to your colleagues at here at McGill is that you're not forced to have to do this, okay? I mean, it's if the investigator chooses to do this, and then you have to have an industrial partner that's willing to do this, okay? So you have to do a soft shoe approach. I know some of the UAM people at McGill have kind of taken an approach of, you know, the activism of the 60s kind of approach. And that doesn't actually work in our environment. What worked at UBC was, I have to admit, her name is Patricia Kretz. She's now a medical intern. She was an amazing, amazing woman. What she did is she started the UAM chapter in 2005, and she rationally and practically was the one that addressed the administration at UBC and said, you know, in a very calm fashion, these are the practical reasons why you need to have this policy in place. And once the upper administration and our director of UILO, University Industrial Liaison Office, signed on, Angus Livingston, then it really was downhill from there. So the way to convince the faculty at McGill to convince the upper administration to follow a global access initiative that we're doing at UBC is first say that, you know, it's not in stone. It's a policy. It's not a policy. Okay, it's a principle. It's something that you don't necessarily have to follow. In my lab, I'm developing 5 or 6 different technologies simultaneously. Only one of them is for global access. Okay, the other ones are, I'm being a greedy pharmacologist. I'm trying to develop it to make money in the old traditional route, but they don't fit the model. That's all. So I think if you do that, if you convince, say to the faculty that, you know, it's just an idea that possibly you can consider, instead of saying you must do it and take a soft shoe approach, I think you'll see a turnaround, because this has gained a momentum worldwide. There was just something signed a few months ago between a number of the major universities in Canada and the U.S. together as a team. And in fact, UBC thought the global access policies of some of the other universities was actually stronger than the UBC one. They were a little hesitant, in fact. So that would be the way I would say that you would approach it.
Okay, if there's I think there's time for maybe one quick more question, but if you don't mind going to the mic, that would be great.
Thank you for the panel, Mr. Eye-opening session. I'm a community pediatrician, and so I have 2 questions. The first one is for Dr. Obalejoro. When you mentioned at the end about venture capital, and I guess it's something touched by the previous question, how would you control, or is it appropriate to have the capital raised within the country, or do you have to approach international level for raising capital and guarantee the delivery more beneficial to the project? And then my second question is for Dr. Michael Clark. When you mentioned about knowledge transfer and capacity building, yeah, I wonder about the sustainability. Once you go from research to policy making, and from my own personal experience, I find quite often by the time a policy maker comes into the picture, the sustainability is often disrupted. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. In terms of venture capital, the best thing is to do as much research as possible using free money before you go out to venture capital. And there are new mechanisms that are being put in place. For example, the African Network in Drug Discovery and Innovation is trying to create a fund where there'd be African-led, African-visioned grant-making institution that could fund researchers that are working in Africa. So that's going to be, hopefully, they're going to start their first round, I think, in October or early January next year. So we're currently looking at funding through Gates, Wellcome Trust, different institutions outside of Africa. But eventually what we hope is to find funding within Africa. And I know the South African government is very active in creating venture capital sector in terms of biotechnology and health. So that's something that we're observing and paying attention to. Mo Ibrahim has created funds to advance innovation in Africa. So there are institutions, there are initiatives that are happening. There's a dream for an African Innovation Fund that would take 0.6% of Africa's GDP that would bring in $1 billion a year of research money. So there are different things happening that will allow to get local funding to move forward. And as local business people see that it's effective and that it's worth buying in, that will be important to bring in private sector funding. So the focus will be in trying to raise as much money as getting close to market from local funds to keep the vision and the leadership local, definitely.
Thank you very much for your question. It's a huge challenge for our researchers and the projects that we develop with them to bring the outputs and outcomes of research into the policy arena. It's not a normal gathering of like minds when you put together researchers and policymakers. There is a bit of a culture clash in that arena. However, it's important from a principled point of view. And so one of the most effective ways we have found to do that is to bring the policymaker into the project right from the very beginning. And the work that Hamish might be describing this afternoon, I don't know if you're going to touch on that, but in some of the work, for example, we're doing in Rwanda, we had the Minister of Health at our inaugural meeting with the researchers. And this has happened in many, many other situations where we're trying to bring the policymakers as part of the research program. And so at least we have the built-in dialogue and relationship that's developed. But the real challenge, of course, is attribution. And that is when policy eventually does reflect research, the research may have been done 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. And of course, agencies like to be able to attribute what they do to that kind of an outcome, and it's not a straight line. In fact, I'm sure many of the positive outcomes that we've had in the policy arena, we don't even know about because we don't have a mechanism for following up over that long term the way we can do in shorter term projects. And indeed, we try and aim for influence on policy from very early stages, as I say, and we have several examples where that has been effective.
Okay, so I think we're out of time for this panel, but there's now a break until 11:30, and please join me in thanking the panelists for a wonderful start to the session.